Good afternoon, everyone. LJ here. Or good day, I should say. I shouldn't say good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. LJ here, the podcast guy, the entrepreneur. Well, I am an entrepreneur, but I don't know. It's a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. It's a fun day, and don't know where you're at. If you're in California, you may be experiencing some high winds, high surf. But if you're in the eastern part, you're suffering from some cold. We're going to be talking about energy today, and so I'm going to start the podcast a little differently. So, what are your thoughts about energy? What are your thoughts about where you live and how we consume fuel and fossils and wind and everything else like that to make our energy? Because energy is kind of up in the air, and we have a special guest today that is going to talk a whole lot about a technology that he has both invented, and he's rocking and rolling with it, which is pretty cool. And it's kind of a disruptive technology that will help lower all of our utility bills. And he's going to be addressing some of that in the United States and all over the world, to be honest with you. So with that, I'd like to introduce to you my guest, Nick Watson. Nick has a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering from the University of Wisconsin. He's the founder of so many different intellectual properties that relate to chemical engineering. He has 25 years of experience in different, clean energy. He's worked with companies like Eastman Kodak, Bosch Lomb, American Red Cross, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm very, very excited to introduce to you my guest, Nick Watson. Good afternoon, Nick.
Good afternoon, Lauren. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, I can hear you well. Yeah, turn up all those volumes, and I think we're rocking and rolling, so it's all good. So listen, I introduced you, and like, what are our thoughts today about energy and stuff like that? But before we get started, what's the funniest thing you've seen in the last 72 hours?
Funniest things I see.
Yeah. What's the funniest thing? Have you been to Walmart? I think Walmart's an entertaining place sometimes. You see some funny things.
I have been to Walmart, not lately, but I have had experience in Walmart where people come dressed in special attire, let's
Well,
say.
let's define that special attire for a second here. What do you mean? Pajamas?
With a full cat costume. Shopping. And it wasn't Halloween.
It wasn't Halloween,
It was not Halloween.
and they were dressed up in a cat suit.
They had the cat makeup on and makeup on their face.
Really?
It was interesting.
Yeah. Well, I've had some interesting moments in Walmart, and I just I don't know. I fall out laughing and everything, so it's pretty incredible and everything. So, well, let's talk a little bit about your background and everything. I know you're an engineer, a chemical engineer from University of Wisconsin, but let's talk a little bit about your childhood and how you grew up. Where'd you grow up at, and what'd your parents do for a living? And just kind of share some stuff with me.
Oh, sure thing. I actually had the benefit of growing up in two different areas. My parents are from Georgia. My dad is a country boy, and my mom is a city girl. And somehow the two met, and they created me. Right?
Yeah.
And the country area of Atlanta was very fun and interesting as a youth. You got to run through the rural areas of the country. We got to do a lot of activities outside. When I was growing up, we didn't have the video phones because they didn't even exist. They were still phones hooked to the wall for some of your younger listeners, and that did exist back way back in the day. Right? But it was fun growing up in the country area, in the rural area. You lived off the land, and that's what my dad and his siblings did. They lived off the land. My dad is from a family of 14,
Wow.
there's eight boys and the remaining are girls. I believe that's six when I do the math. He met my mom in the city. Dad fancied himself a little bit as a baseball player, an amateur baseball player.
Okay.
He met my mom at a young age, and they decided, hey, we want to start a family together. I eventually moved west, where I spent a lot of my, my teen years. Dad, growing up on the farm, didn't have a lot of opportunity for education. He has a sixth grade education.
Okay.
If opportunities had been presented to him, he probably would have been a mathematician because he's very, very good. It's probably where I get some of my traits from.
Sure.
To a trade school and learn how to do typewriting type of things and computer programming with punch cards and things. But
punch cards.
Going to college, I fancied myself a little bit of an athlete. I wasn't all that good, but I was good enough to get the attention of some of the college recruits. Awesome. Still didn't get to play much, if any.
What sport did you play?
The attention in school to further my education. I ended up getting a chemical engineering degree from the University of Wisconsin, and I ended up working for a lot of different companies, such as Eastman Kodak Company, which some of your listeners may recall used to be a film company.
Yeah.
Where they made acetate type film for pictures. I work for Bausch & Lomb, and some of your listeners may be familiar with Bausch & Lomb because they're an eye company.
Yeah.
They make contact lenses and some of the medical liquids that are utilized for your eye care. I even worked for the American Red Cross at one point. I helped produce plasma, red blood cells, white blood cells, and
so on. Wow.
You have to separate whole blood to get those. And as a chemical engineer, that's kind of right up our alley too. So I've done a lot of interesting things. But the main thing throughout my career, I worked in the waste treatment applications and generating energy and electricity for those various entities so that they could produce and manufacture the products that they did. And that's really what got me through my 25 years of experiences is working with fossil fuel energy producers and wastewater treatment producers to achieve a certain amount of environmental serenity for the community that I love and live in. So
that's pretty awesome, you know.
Sums it up to some degree.
Yeah. What sport did you play in?
Well, I was actually a dual. Back then, you could still do dual. I was basketball and football.
Okay.
I was a much, much better football player than basketball.
Yeah. All right.
Although, for some reason, I like basketball. I'm 6'2 on a good day.
Yeah, right. On a good day. Yeah.
In my mind, I was 6'7, 6'8.
Yeah. Right. So that's funny.
I envisioned that I was much taller than I was, and I really wanted to play basketball more than football. But my college letters for sports mainly came from the football, and so I was just good enough to be redshirted,
and to
be on the practice squad.
Yeah,
it got me an excellent education, as you stated to your audience. I do have a bachelor's of science degree in chemical engineering from the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Well, that's pretty good. I just brag about our grandson, Alex Starcher. He's he's a 6'5". He got injured his last basketball game, but he's been looked at by so many colleges right now. He's a junior in high school, and he goes to a Christian school and everything. But it is amazing to watch him come along and everything. I mean, I, you know, there Liberty University's looked at him. I mean, there's all kinds of people that are touting him right now, and he's got some great stats. But basketball is a lot of fun to watch. Football, I played football in high school. I played outside linebacker, and I didn't play in college, but I played in high school, and I played a little bit of fullback and everything. So that's pretty cool. I mean, I think athletics and family environments, I think, add so much to the discipline that we get in life. Right?
I agree 100%. Being an athlete in my younger years taught me the meaning of teamwork.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Being able to accomplish objectives with a team. Right? I had leadership roles, and I had roles when I had to be a follower. And to me, the perfect leader is a good follower. They know when to listen. They know when to be quiet, and they know when to take specific actions. And I learned a lot in being involved in athletics that, to me, helped me as I transitioned into the business world.
You know, I think you're spot on. I mean, I didn't, to be honest with you. I mean, it's, I don't go into a lot of details, but I didn't have the best family life. And sports was kind of a go-to for me to play baseball and play football. And all my coaches, they weren't like a father to me, but the whole process, like you said, I mean, it was amazing to grow in your sports and then having an outlet in order to manage those things. And I would have to agree with you 100% where I think it's important that we learn teamwork and we learn those energies at an early age, because I think once we do transition into the business world, I think it's all of a sudden a match, you know. And I think when you get back down to it, to be honest with you, Nick, we're all in the people business, right?
Yeah.
I don't think some business, I know the bigger companies don't look at it as a people business, but I think the smaller companies look at it as a people business. And there's always a financial tie to everything. And I get that. But so where do you think you got your entrepreneur, where'd you get that interest from?
I think I got it from my dad and his brothers and sisters. My dad was a steel worker. He started off just because of his sixth grade education. He just started off just being a floor sweeper. But he quickly moved up in the ranks over 30 years and ended up being a foreman of his operations. And in that, he learned a certain amount of independence where he was very good with his hands, so he could build things or construct things that made your life a little easier, right? And from that, I learned that he sometimes will apply that in the neighborhood. You know, someone may need a help with their vehicle, or there may be a help with a washing machine or something like that. Dad could do those things, and he had that entrepreneur spirit, where he didn't give much money for it.
Right.
He gave back to his community, right? And to me, that's an entrepreneur spirit. You give back. You look over your shoulder and say, hey, how can I give back? How can I reach behind as I'm reaching for the future? I didn't say he looked back. I said
right.
He gave back.
Yeah.
And that, to me, really built that. And then I had uncles and aunts who had their own little companies. You know, they had bakeries, they had dry cleaners.
Oh wow.
All those repair shops, and you know, and even one uncle had a barbecue joint. So I learned from them, my aunts and uncles on my dad's side, what it's like to serve your community, and also what it's like to manage a household when you're doing that, and with the understanding that as much that is given to someone, much you have to give out. Right? You receive a lot, but you have to also give a lot too. And I learned that spirit, and I think that's what I learned growing up. I mean, my dad never missed a day of work, and working in the Midwest, when he moved from Georgia to the Midwest, it snowed out there. It got cold out there. And he walked, he pushed through the snow. He was very proud of never missing a day of work. And those qualities and those characteristics he instilled in his kids, so that we had a certain work ethic. And I think that also helps you with that entrepreneur spirit.
I think, you know, we go back to the core values, but, you know, my father-in-law, he worked in a steel plant in Ashland, Kentucky, and he would never miss a day of work, and he worked shift work and everything else like that. But I wonder why that age demographic had those things. I know we talk a little bit about history, but I think, I don't know, maybe the depression and all that stuff played a role in them stepping up and never missing work so they could have money to put food on the table.
I think you're spot on. It's the struggle that gave them strength.
Yeah, okay.
The struggle that built characters.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was the struggle that told them that, hey, I need to do this to better my lot in life and my family. And I want to make sure that my children understand that, you know, you have to work to receive your rewards. And there's nothing wrong with working hard.
Right? Right.
But if you do work hard, you can get a lot of rewards from that.
Right? Yeah.
And I think that's what our parents and relatives taught us, Lauren.
You know,
as well as probably a lot of your listeners.
Yeah, right. You know, what is the name of your company? I don't think I gave shout out to your LLC.
Oh, absolutely. It's Upshots, Upshots LLC.
Okay.
That's our company. That's our parent company. We have a variety of subsidiaries, which is under the guise of Upshots Energy Development.
Okay.
All right. There will be other subsidiaries. There will be an Upshots Microgrid Development. But anything with the Upshots name as it pertains to energy is pretty much associated with my role.
Yeah, the LLC is a good way to organize your company. I mean, I've been a sole proprietor, and I've been, you know, a C-Corp and LLC. And so, you know, I've had a flavor of each organization, if you will. But, you know, the name of your company means final outcome. That's the definition of Upshot.
Absolutely. You've done your research.
Yeah. So when you stop and think about it, man, I mean, the word has a lot of meaning behind it, because you are you're doing some work in the final stages, or having an outcome of energy. And so, you know, we're going to shift gears here a little bit and talk about the primary energy sources in the U.S. You know, as we both know, they're petroleum, natural gas, coal, nuclear energy, and renewable sources. And we all talk about electricity, and we think that's the primary source of I guess maybe the grid or whatever. But we think electricity is the focus of all of our energy sources. But we don't realize what it takes to get electricity, because really electricity is a secondary source of energy, right?
Yes. You're spot on. Energy, to produce any type of energy, there's a risk that's associated with it. And most of that risk is attached to environment. To some degree, right? That risk can be high, it can be moderate, or it can be low. But I think me and you and your listeners understand that with any endeavor that you take on, there's a risk associated with it, and you have to mitigate that risk. Right?
I apologize. I'm having a bark episode, and it's not a very good one right now, and I don't even know why they're barking, but they were all asleep. So go ahead.
I think they were enjoying our conversation.
I think so too. Yeah.
So as you look at fossil fuel energy production, which has been the prevalent means by which we produce energy since the Industrial Revolution, we have used either a solid, such as coal, right, wood, that's still fossil. We have used a liquid, but you can have propane gas.
Right.
Right? And we have used as well. Right?
Oh, my. Stop it. Stop it now. Okay. I'm so sorry. The disruptive was a FedEx man at my door.
I still think they're just excited about our discussion about energy.
Yeah. They're always excited about discussions. Go ahead.
All right. So with fossil fuel energy producers, there's part of that risk and part of the making of energy. You make other byproducts from it, all right? And some of the energy producers, especially when they were looking at coal, which was a prevalent energy producer for not just the United States, but the global community, all right? There were other byproducts from it, all right? And from coal as well as oil, they were able to create things such as gasoline. That's why we have gasoline vehicles. That was came about during the Industrial Revolution as we started to look at some of the byproducts that was created when you combust a fuel, right? Or when you process a fuel, you created other byproducts and you try to determine if those off byproducts can be beneficially used for society at large. Our challenge now, as we become more aware as a community with regards to the environmental impact of energy production, is how do we mitigate the risks associated with energy production? And right now, the big thing is with coal fire operations, which utilize coal, which I believe a lot of your listeners are familiar with,
right.
It creates what they call a coal combustion residue, or what we call ash,
okay.
Coal ash, right? And coal ash has a shelf life, probably close. Nothing is infinity, but you're gonna easily get 50,000 years out of coal ash.
Wow.
I mean, it's not gonna go away.
Wow.
So what do you do with that element? You can store it, which is what we have been doing. We store it in coal ponds, and we call them coal ponds because the ash is stored wet. I think anyone who's been around an ash when you barbecue, you know that when it burns, it turns into ash, of course, and that ash can become airborne if a good breeze comes by.
Right.
Right. So just think of having millions and millions of tons of ash just sitting on the ground. That could get into the air, and that can be an environmental and health issue for everyone in the country, the state, the city, or town that you live in. And so the energy producers came up with a very good solution from its conceptual start, which is let's just put it in water so that it doesn't become airborne and we can store it. Because there's no way we're going to get rid of it, all right? But we have to be able to store it. So they will dig a hole in the ground and start dumping it in there and making sure there's water in there so that it doesn't become airborne. So that solved the problem that the coal ash wouldn't get entrenched in the air. And me, you, and the other citizens of that state, that town, that city, we wouldn't breathe it in.
Right.
And unfortunately, when we did that as a energy company that was fossil fuel based, the concentrations of those of the chemicals in the coal ash became greater and greater and greater, and you start to build up some toxins, and those toxins that are in the coal ash leaked into the groundwater. Well, groundwater goes to underwater streams. Those underwater streams lead into these lakes and rivers that me and you enjoy with fishing and swimming and,
right.
And just utilize it for drinking water. And then unfortunately, over a period of time, that became at best an environmental nuisance, at best, all right? And so since 2015, 2015, the Environmental Protective Agency mandated that any energy producing entity can no longer store coal ash wet. They must store it dry. Well, that created a problem for all of the energy, the fossil fuel energy producers, because they were accustomed to storing it wet, because that solved the problem of the ash not being entrenched in the air. Now, they had to come up with a different solution because, again, when it was in water, it was linked to groundwater contamination. My company, which I started in 2016, we focus on reducing the environmental risk for fossil fuel energy producers. That is our mission statement. So we start working with energy companies and trying to identify how we can take that waste stream or any of their waste streams and beneficially remediate them, beneficially reuse them so that it benefits the society at large. And over a period of time from 2016 to the present day, we created over a dozen different products from fossil fuel waste. And one of our biggest product lines that we have created is thermal media.
Okay.
We've been able to take coal ash and gob coal, which is also called bony coal, which is also for some of your listeners is waste coal.
Okay.
We're able to chemically and mechanically repurpose that product into a thermal media. And what a thermal media is it allows heat to be captured. All right. It also, a thermal media can insulate heat. So coal ash has both properties. It can either be a good conductor of heat, or it can be a good insulator of heat. And there's over 30 different elements in coal ash.
Wow.
That can be utilized for either or. Right? You just have to create a methodology, a process that is strong enough that it utilize the benefits of those characteristics. Right? We have been able to do that. And by doing that, this beneficial remediation of coal ash and turning it into a thermal media, we're able to utilize that heat to create low-cost electricity. All right? And it's the low-cost electricity that we want to pass on to the ratepayers. Me and you, Lauren, and your listeners, as much as some of your listeners are entrepreneurs, we're all a rate payers.
Right.
So we're paying someone for that electricity, right? And my company has been able to identify that we can take a waste stream and utilizing solar heat, we can store that heat and then convert that heat into electricity that we then send that to the utility companies. And we're asking them, we're begging them with sugar on top, please pass on this low cost energy that we're providing for you. Pass that on to your ratepayers, because me and you, Lauren, are ratepayers. Your listeners are ratepayers. Right? We have also identified that with the wastewater treatment plants, they consume about a third of the energy that is produced in the United States. That's in all 50 states and all the territories. A third of the energy goes to waste treatment plants.
Wow.
Well, we want to provide a low-cost energy so that their kilowatt uses go down. Their therms, which is the heat that is used at these waste treatment plants, because they have a lot of blowers.
Sure.
To dry things out.
Yes.
Right? We want the price of getting that heat to go down. And we can do that with Upshot's technology. And when we do that, right there with a wastewater treatment plant, if we can reduce their electrical costs, right, that cost savings can easily be passed on to the ratepayers, which again are me, you, and the listeners at large.
Yeah. Well, I think if you talk about rate reduction, I think if you look at a waste treatment facility that is usually ran by a city, municipalities and everything, I think one of the things is that they may reinvest that into your technology or another technology, and not so much another technology, but something in order to help their infrastructure, which, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I've never seen a utility company talk about we're going to lower your rates. I mean, can you imagine if organization, PCS, they come up and they, you know, because they're the governing body and everything to rates in all municipalities, and are they statewide or are they just local?
They are statewide, and what Lauren is alluding to all the listeners, the PSC, which is the acronym, Public Service Commissioners, right? So we deal with the Public Service Commissioners in this way. They are an advocate for me, you, as Joe and Mary Citizen, right? I'm Joe Citizen. Here's my wife, Mary Citizen.
Right.
They're our advocates. They're the ones who have steward over making sure that the energy that we get and the municipality services that we get are, one, safe, because we want something safe, but we don't want energy and sewers backing up in our house. And
right, our house, yeah. And
things, no one wants that, all right? So they govern that. They make sure then that the price for those services are reasonable, right? We understand that any company is these are for-profit companies. No one's begrudging them making a profit. They should make a profit.
Sure.
Me and Lauren and your listeners probably all agree. We just don't think it should be over excessive, right? And again, that's not for me or Lauren or maybe the listeners to definitely calculate, but the PSCs, the Public Service Commissioners, are given that duty to make sure that when they charge a price, that the price is reasonable for their constituents, all right? Then they want to make sure that things, again, are environmentally safe, because we all have to live on this rock that we saw, the third rock from the sun, all right? And we want to make sure that this rock that we live on keeps revolving. And so they want to make sure that any risks that are associated with producing that energy is mitigated, all right? And that's where the PSC can have a strong arm with reducing the cost.
So how does that, like, okay, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no.
So I think what's interesting is that so we talk a little bit about your business model, and we talk a little bit about the disruptive technology that you're into. So let's take a look at, let's say we're drawing circles and we're trying to figure out, okay, we have the consumer, the ratepayer. We've got AEP, we've got, you know, some rural electricity companies. We have, plants. We have all these. And then we have the city government that is managing a lot of this stuff. I mean, who is your primary customer, or is it spread out to educate all the people?
I would say it's spread out to educate all the people. But okay, what we try to do is we first focus on the heavy hitters. Right? We know if we provide a low-cost energy source for the government, right, that they have the infrastructure in place to pass that energy onto the consumer, which is again me, you, and the listeners, right? And they have the infrastructure to help lower the cost. So if they're buying it from us below cost, average spot price, right? And it's below the average spot price, they can surely help facilitate adding passing those savings on to their constituents. So we focus on the government first. So we, back in 2019, 2020, we did a work agreement for the Department of Energy. We demonstrated that our technology works. And they paid us. They paid us handsomely for it. And part of what we demonstrated, we showed that you could harvest these various elements that I spoke of, over 30-something different elements that are in coal ash, how you could harvest those for the beneficial use of the government. And one particular element is what they call critical earth elements or rare earth elements. Me and you, Lauren, we're probably more familiar with it, but I suspect you have some very savvy listeners who are also familiar with it.
Right.
And these critical earth elements are utilizing anything from anything and everything from the phones that me and you are using to the computers and the microphones that we're talking on with. They use critical earth elements. And what we did as a company for the United States, we identified that you can harvest some of those critical earth elements from coal ash, which is a waste stream.
Right.
And most of the critical earth elements that we use for consumer usage do not come from the United States, do not come from North America, right? They come from China. They come another segment of the global community, right? And unfortunately, China has a hold on critical earth elements, which is somewhere between 70 to 80% of the market share for critical earth elements that, again, are used in over 200 different products.
Okay. What define a little bit about those critical elements, just, you know, I know there's 200 and some, but what are those critical elements that okay.
So what happens with these critical earth elements, they are utilized in some of these commercial products that we use for everyday living.
Gotcha. Okay. So it's like the copper, it's like, you know, a lot of other elements other than coal, right?
Right.
Okay.
It's more exotic elements other than copper.
That's what I thought.
More of the known elements. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, cool. All right.
So those things become very expensive because the critical earth elements have a physical characteristics that allows them to have properties that can be multiplied stronger or larger. So let's say copper has a conductive property of 1x. Maybe a critical earth element that we use of the same quantity. Let's say you have 1 ounce of copper and it has a physical property of 1x. The critical earth elements that does the same thing that copper can have a physical property that's 20x.
Okay. 30x.
All right. So you can use the same quantity of the elements, but you get so much more from it. And that's why they're so expensive. And that's why they're so widely sought after.
Okay.
And they're rare.
Right. So you're attacking this basically in the United States, right? You're not anywhere.
That's correct.
Overseas or anything else like that, right?
Not yet. We're focusing on the United States first. We have a 5-year plan here for the state to roll out our technology. After which, we have another 5-year plan that follows the first 5-year plan that's for deployment in the United States. We then pivot to outside of, let's say, North America.
Okay.
Because in the United States, we include the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Greenland, which is all of North America, as means by which to deploy our technology here.
Okay.
The first 5 years.
So when you're talking about the deployment and everything else like that, so you've been working. You mentioned the Department of Energy, and that's pretty high up in the government steps. And we haven't broached the thing about politics, because every politician at that level, even local levels, if they're Democrat or if they're Republican, they tout their energy beliefs and ideology. And so it always seems like on a voting day, there's confusion, you know, I mean, because if somebody's voted, you know, and they believe, you know, a little bit greener, and then the every other person believes in oil, then all the stuff, all the technology that has been, I guess, signed off on changes, and then we're kind of in a kind of a room that everything's closed off, because it takes years to integrate new technology. Correct?
Correct, sir. Correct. Right. And from my perspective, and I'm speaking clearly from Nick Watson Upshot's perspective. Right. I embrace, enjoy green technology. What we're creating is green technology.
Okay.
However, in the same vein, I will say that fossil fuel energy production is still going to be around for a little while, right? And what you can do with fossil fuel energy production, you can reduce the amount of CO2 that's being discharged, right? When you reasonably and responsibly integrate fossil fuel with alternative energy supplies, right? Fossil fuel energy production, in my opinion, and this is my opinion only, it is not going to go anywhere anytime soon, right? It's going to take decades and many, many decades by which to completely depart from fossil fuels.
Like coal?
We need to have a reliable supply of energy. Me and Lauren have talked offline where I said, Lauren, I'll give you energy energy on Wednesday, all right? And other people in the community, they'll have certain days. But can you imagine just being assigned a specific day in which you can have energy, and then the other days you don't have any energy? You'll have anarchy in your community.
Yeah, so we almost have anarchy in our streets, just FYI.
So true. So I think anybody who responsibly want to have a very real discussion about energy production and pivoting toward alternative energy supplies would recognize that it's not going to happen overnight, and that the transition into alternative energy supply should be thought out, should be very methodical, it should be very succinct. And if you give ourselves, our community, time to do that, we can do it. And that's where the various administrations come in, and they try to give you a guideline. They may say, well, we're going to try to go to alternative energy supplies by 2050 or 2075 or 2030. Right? All of these are guesstimates, estimates, your best estimates. But to do that, you have to have a reliable, and that's the key word, reliable supply of alternative energy. And right now, our supply, as we move with the technology is growing, and it's transitioning, and it's pivoting, and it's emerging, but it's not completely reliable yet.
Right.
It took us hundreds of years since the Industrial Revolution to get to where we are with fossil fuels. So how can you expect over 10 or 15 or 20 years to immediately turn to alternative energy supply? It has to nurture, it has to grow, it has to be demonstrated that it is reliable, and that takes time. And I think if everyone on either side of the aisle, and either in the middle, all right, if we just all just take a deep breath and says, okay, we all mean well. We all want to keep this planet revolving. We all want to provide for our children, children's children. All right? So, since we're all acting in good faith, let's have a good faith discussion that allows us to pivot toward alternative energy source, but doesn't blindside what we currently have. All right? It's the old saying that granddad used to tell me. You can throw out the wash water. You can throw out the baby, but keep the wash water.
Right.
Well, that's what sometimes we end up doing. All right. Fossil fuels, will it eventually go away? Yes. But it has to mature the alternative energy supplies. And I'm an alternative energy supplier. All right. It has to mature before you can immediately dismiss fossil fuels. And in the interim, you should allow fossil fuels to decrease, but decrease responsibly.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And there's ways in which you can do that.
Well, you have, here's part of the deal in my mind. I think that, you know, we're so reliant on, we haven't even made the transition into the wind, you know, and everything. And like, you know, the wind, you know, comes and goes. Water comes and goes. I mean, there's no dependable source of energy. We're mixed ideology wise. We're mixed contractually with other sources. And there's been a lot of people that have made tons of business in the wind business and water business and fossil fuels and everything. I think I understand what you're talking about, but I think to be honest with you, excuse me, and I think, you know, you were talking about working with the Department of Energy. I think those steps are very critical, and I think that even though it would take time, I think that if it's kind of like supply and demand, to be honest with you, I think it could hit the market fast. And I think that if you have a patent on it and you're tweaking it and you're making things right, I just don't think that, you know, it's going to take 100 years in order to shift gears. I think, you know, one of the things, and I don't know your strategy for implementation, but you're currently working with some states right now, right, in order to get this off the ground.
Absolutely. And let me just be very clear. I don't believe it's going to take 100 years for the transition. We're already transitioning right now.
Okay.
I just think it's going to take time to develop the statistical merit of your technology.
Yeah.
All right. You have to statistically prove that this thing is reproducible. All right. It has to work yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Okay.
Fossil fuels, whether you like it or not, it took 200 years for us to get to where we're at with fossil fuels, right? And it showed over and over that it was consistent.
Right.
The same thing is going to occur with alternative energy supply.
Yes.
We're going through this transitional period, but it's going to take time so you can statistically prove that it works yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Yeah.
Reliable energy.
You know, and I've heard that the coal sources, and I know that we're not going to, you know, solely depend on coal, but coal is such a key ingredient right now to our energy. I mean, I was in Virginia, or I went through Virginia Beach, or I don't know, somewhere to go down to the beach for Thanksgiving, and we passed this coal place where there was a bunch of ships, and so we export a lot of coal. And we keep it home and we use it. I mean, you know, a lot of people thought, well, you know, one government's going to close down the coal mines, the other one's going to keep them open. And we're not at full production. As I understand it, the coal reserves are anywhere between 400 to 600 years out before they may go out, if you will, of coal. So I think that you're right as far as the data is concerned, but I think that people don't realize. I mean, I've got some relatives that, you know, they they're kind of, and nothing against green people, and I know you're green and everything, but I just I just think we have to be smart about what we're doing, and I think that people are looking at coal as if though it's a demon, you know, and that wind is king and all this other stuff, and that's the problem in my mind.
You're spot on, Lauren. Therein lies the rub, right there. All right. Wind, as much as we love wind, and me and you and the rest of your listeners, we all breathe this thing called air. It's about 71% nitrogen and the remaining is oxygen. All right. When it's working good. But me and you've been outside, as well as your listeners. There's days when it's not that much of wind blowing. Alright? And you may say, well, the windmills are elevated. They're five stories high. So you have a wind current going there. Yes, you do. But again, the wind has to be blowing to turn
right.
The windmills. Alright? The same with solar energy. Right now, solar energy works very well when you have the sun shining. And when the sun isn't shining, like, let's say, for example, at night.
Right.
Not so much. You don't get a lot of solar energy at night. That's where our technology comes in, where we can store the heat for long durations. Right? And that's where, when you alluded to, how are we deploying our technology, we're starting with a pre-commercial runs in three states, Georgia, Tennessee, and West Virginia, all right, where we're going to demonstrate that we can store heat from the sun when the sun is shining, and when the sun is not shining, all right, we can still have a reliable supply of heat, all right, that can be utilized to make electricity. So that's what they call long duration energy storage. They use the acronym, they being the energy sectors, use the acronym LDES, long duration energy storage.
Okay.
And if you Google that acronym, you'll read a whole bunch about it. What we're creating with Upshots in Georgia, Tennessee, and West Virginia is what we call a microgrid. All right. A microgrid is just a group of interconnected electrical loads. In other words, it's just a group of wires, all right? Distribution wires, and they distribute the energy from its microgrid to the primary grid, all right? And that's within a clearly defined boundary, electrical boundary, all right? So what's nice about creating a microgrid, and what the government has done, they say, well, if you have a microgrid, in the event that your electrical grid, and that's what me and you utilize, me, you, and your listeners, we all are hooked to the electrical grid. A microgrid provides that energy to the electrical grid. However, if the electrical grid goes down for any reason, like in Texas when they had that coal spill, and
right,
they couldn't get electricity, my Upshots microgrid will still be operating because we have stored the heat, all right? And the heat will still be able to create electricity, all right? Even though in Texas, during that particular instance that I'm talking about, there was record heat.
Right. Right?
Heat is my friend.
Yes.
For my technology, all right? And so you have to be able to understand that as you pivot to this alternative energy supply, that everything isn't just going to happen overnight, right? And as I say, with solar, and solar is my friend, for some reason, trying to get solar energy in the middle of the night or when there's overcast days, but for some reason on this planet, it rains in some part of this country. In other parts of the country, it's not only rains, it snows, right? And the sun may not be shining. So if you can't store the heat during the days in which it was shining, where you were able to grab an abundance of heat and store it, you're then only using solar on demand. All right. And that means, I mean, not on demand, you're only using solar right then and there.
Right.
All right. You don't have it on demand. You're using it right then and there. And once the sun goes down, or it's a overcast days, you have no heat. And if you have no heat, you have no electricity. Right? And that's where the technology has to mature. Energy storage is what I'm speaking of. And that's what our company does. And we beneficially remediate a waste stream from the fossil fuel energy producers. We beneficially remediate, which means we create a beneficial product from a waste that then stores heat. And as I say, if we store heat, we can create electricity. And we're going to store heat for during our pre-commercial runs. We're going to demonstrate that we can store heat for a minimum of 72 hours.
Okay.
I believe once we get started with our process, I'm going to be able to demonstrate heat storage around 30 days. That's unheard of right now.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
No one can store heat for 30 days.
Yeah. So let me ask you something, Nick.
That's what we're going to be.
Awesome. Let me ask you, all this stuff is patent, right? I mean, there's nobody that can.
Patent or patent pending. Yes.
Okay. In the middle of patent pending, can they grab your idea and run with it? Or is there some legal consequences?
Patent pending. They cannot grab it because you have already entered, you know, your intellectual property. Yes.
Okay. So you're funded partially by some grants and some other things, but you're looking for more investors at the current time in order to roll this out efficiently to Georgia, Tennessee, and West Virginia, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. How would people actually get in touch with you to help you financially and get some more information on that? How would they do that?
Well, one way they can reach me at my email. All right. The easiest email is N Watson. That's N as in Nick, Watson as in my last name, WATSON, at upshotsinc.com.
Cool.
UPSHOTSINC.com. That's one way. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I think, you know, when people look at investors and everything else like that, it's kind of like on Shark Tank, you know, they look at the valuation of a company and if there's been sales, you know, the sharks go, oh, okay, all right. So your valuation is at $62 million. Oh, okay, all right. But I'm only generating $100,000 in income right now. So, but I think your technology has been, you've taken the pencil to it and sharpened it. Because you're an engineer, and I think that's very positive. So I think it's going to have a positive influence in this country and probably throughout the world. As you mentioned, maybe you and I may not be around to see, but you're kind of like, and I maybe this is crazy, but what about Watson himself? Wasn't he a genius? And I guess I'm making a kind of a connection with you and Watson, but because they were genius, he was a genius, and he propagated a lot of different things. I think it's also interesting too is that the light bulb itself, when it was tested, and there's so many players in there. I mean, if you mention, you know, some players, they'll say, oh yeah, I remember him. But there was a lot of failures, and there was a lot of testing, and there was a lot of data that was gathering. And so I think your protocols are well set in all of this. And
once again, you're spot on. Anytime you're going with an emerging technology, you have to show reproducibility. Right? When electricity came out, starting off, it failed. And it failed miserably.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
And then it started to gain traction. And it took reproducibility. You have to do it again. Then do it again. Then do it again. And when you're done with that, do it one more time.
Yeah, right? Right. Yeah. And it goes back to, and we're going to have to wrap this up. This is probably my longest podcast I've ever had, which is pretty cool. But one of the things I think that we have to understand that energy and technology, and it goes back to the entrepreneur. Sometimes the entrepreneur fails a lot of times in order to succeed. Okay. And I think you know, you having the tools as an entrepreneur, you had great success in other disciplines, and so you're well set in terms of having all this. But I think, you know, in my world, I've had failures and successes and businesses and everything, and I think, you know, that's part of being an entrepreneur, and I think that's part of everyday life. I think people don't ride a huge train every day when they wake up. You know, each day is unique. God gives us breath and sunlight, and we have to take advantage of that day. So, but I really want to thank you for being on today's show. And like I said, this thing could probably go on for another hour because there's so much information. And I just want to let everybody know that there's about, I don't know, almost 200 people on our live cast right now. And if you have any questions, please answer them in the podcast or send me one. You guys have all my, you know, information on my website and everything else like that. And so, you know, you can listen to us on Spotify or whatever. And you know, we're in, it's interesting because we're in Ghana. We have listeners in Thailand, and we've got listeners in Iran, which is absolutely insane. And, you know, in California and everything. And so listen, just thank you so much, Nick, for being on this. And we really appreciate your information. And there'd probably be a follow-up, and I'll be sending out some information to folks, and we'll just keep this on track and everything. So thank you so much. I just feel blessed that you were on the show today.
So much more that we
yeah, there is. I think we just scratched the surface, to be honest with you. Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, you have a blessed day and everything, and thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, you have my information. Any of your listeners, if they want to have more contact information on us, by all means, contact Lauren and his entity, and you can get more information on Upshots.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much. Take care, bro.